For first, in the first book on nature, likening the eternal motion to a Kaikian, stirring and mixing up now this thing, now that, among the things that come to be, he has said this. Since the administration of the whole proceeds thus, it is necessary that we be in accordance with it, however we happen to be at any time, whether diseased contrary to our own nature, or maimed, or having become grammarians or musicians. And again, a little further on, by this same reasoning we shall say similar things about our virtue and about our vice, and in general about the arts and the lack of arts, as I said. And a little further, removing all ambiguity. For nothing whatever, not even the smallest particular thing, can come to be otherwise than in accordance with the common nature and its reason. And that the common nature and the common reason of nature are fate and providence, and Zeus has not escaped notice even of the Antipodes. For this is proclaimed everywhere by the Stoics themselves. And he says that Homer spoke rightly in saying, and the will of Zeus was being fulfilled, referring this to fate and to the nature of the whole, in accordance with which all things are governed. How then can it be, at once, that God is responsible for nothing shameful, and also that not even the smallest thing can come to be otherwise than in accordance with the common nature and its reason? For among all the things that come to be, shameful things surely are included. And yet Epicurus, in some manner, twists and contrives, devising a way to free and release the voluntary from the eternal motion, so as not to leave vice unaccountable. Whereas Chrysippus grants it unrestrained license, holding that it comes to be not only by necessity, nor merely according to fate, but also according to the reason of God, and according to a nature that has been made the best possible. Moreover, these words too are found, stated in this very form. Since the common nature extends to all things, everything that comes to be in any way whatsoever in the whole, and in any of its parts, must come to be in accordance with that nature and its reason in unhindered sequence. Because there is nothing external that could obstruct the administration, nor does any of the parts have any way of being moved or disposed otherwise than in accordance with the common nature. What then are the dispositions and motions of the parts? Clearly the dispositions are the vices and the diseases, avarice, love of pleasure, love of glory, cowardice, injustice, and the motions are adulteries, thefts, betrayals, murders, parricides. Of these Chrysippus thinks that neither small nor great occurs apart from the reason of Zeus and his law and justice and providence, so that lawbreaking does not occur apart from the law, nor wrongdoing apart from justice, nor evildoing apart from providence. And yet he says that God punishes vice and does many things for the punishment of the wicked, as in the second book on the gods. Sometimes, he says, unpleasant things happen to good men, not, as with the base, for the sake of punishment, but according to a different dispensation, as in cities. And again in the same passage. First, concerning evils, one must listen in a manner similar to what has already been said. Then, that these are apportioned according to the reason of Zeus, either for punishment or according to some other dispensation bearing some relation to the whole. This too, then, is a terrible thing, that vice both comes to be and is punished according to the reason of Zeus. And he intensifies the contradiction, writing this in the second book on nature. Vice, in relation to the terrible mishaps, has a certain proper rationale of its own. For it too comes to be, in some way, according to the reason of nature, and, so to speak, does not come to be uselessly with respect to the whole. For otherwise the good itself would not exist. And this same man rebukes those who argue equally on both sides of a question, he who, from his utter determination to want to say something, and something distinctive and extraordinary about everything, says not uselessly that purse-cutting and sycophancy and folly are, not uselessly, useless things harmful, ill-starred. Then what sort of being is Zeus, I mean Chrysippus? Zeus, punishing a thing that arises neither from himself nor uselessly. For vice, according to Chrysippus' own account, is altogether beyond reproach, whereas Zeus is open to reproach, whether he has made vice a useless thing, or, having made it not uselessly, punishes it. Again, in the first book on justice, having spoken about the gods as opposing certain acts of injustice, he says that vice cannot altogether be removed, nor is it good that it should be removed. But whether it is not good that lawlessness, injustice, and folly be removed is not a question for the present discussion. The point is that he himself, so far as it lies with him, does away with vice through philosophizing, vice which, he says, it is not good to do away with, thereby doing something at odds both with reason and with God. And moreover, in saying that God opposes certain acts of injustice, he again gives the impression that human wrongdoings are impious. Further, concerning the claim that nothing in the cosmos is blameworthy or reprehensible, since all things are produced according to the best nature, though he has often written this, there are places where again he leaves certain culpable acts of negligence, and not about small or trivial matters. At any rate, in the third book on being, mentioning that certain things of this kind happen to good and noble men, he says, "Is it perhaps that, while some things are neglected, just as in larger households some bran and a few grains of wheat fall by the wayside though the whole is well managed, or is it because inferior demons are placed in charge of such matters, among whom culpable negligences do in fact occur?" And he says that a great deal of necessity is also mixed in. Now, to compare such misfortunes of good and noble men, such as the condemnation of Socrates and the burning alive of Pythagoras by the followers of Cylon, and the killing of Zeno at the hands of the tyrant Demilus, and the torturing to death of Antiphon by Dionysius, to grains of bran falling aside, betrays how great a facility for such things he has. I let that pass. But that inferior demons should, by providence, be set over such supervisions. How is that not a charge against God, just as it would be against a king who entrusts administrations to bad and reckless satraps and generals, and looks on while the best men are neglected and abused by them? And indeed, if a great deal of necessity is mixed into affairs, then God neither controls all things, nor are all things administered according to his reason. He fights most of all against Epicurus and against those who do away with providence, on the basis of the conceptions we have concerning the gods, conceiving them as beneficent and humane. And since these things are written and said in many places among the Stoics themselves, there was no need to cite passages and to add that all the gods are good. For consider what the Jews and Syrians think about the gods, consider how full of superstition the works of the poets are. But hardly anyone, so to speak, conceives of God as perishable and having come to be. Of all the others to pass them by, Antipater of Tarsus in his work on the gods writes this verbatim: "Before the whole account, we shall briefly set out the clear conception we have concerning God. We conceive of God, then, as a blessed and imperishable living being and beneficent to human beings." Then, expounding each of these points, he says, "And indeed, all men consider them imperishable." Chrysippus, then, is not of all men, according to Antipater, for he thinks that none of the gods is imperishable except fire, but that all of them alike have come to be and will perish. And this is said by him virtually everywhere. I shall cite a passage from the third book on the gods. By another account, some are said to be generated and perishable, others ungenerated, and this must be shown from the beginning in a more physical manner. For the sun and moon and the other gods, having a similar rationale, are generated, but Zeus is eternal. And again, going on, similar things will be said concerning their perishing and their coming to be, both regarding the other gods and Zeus, for the others perish, but of Zeus, his parts are imperishable. To these I wish further to set alongside a few of the things said by Antipater. Those who strip away beneficence from the gods attack, in part, the preconception we have of them. By the same reasoning, so do those who think them to partake of generation and destruction. If, then, one who thinks the gods perishable is equally absurd as one who does not think them provident and beneficent, then Chrysippus has fallen equally short as Epicurus. For the one takes away their beneficence, the other their imperishability. Moreover, in the third book on the gods, Chrysippus says this about the other gods being nourished: "The other gods make use of nourishment, being sustained by it in a similar manner. But Zeus and the cosmos are sustained in a different way, the substances being consumed and coming to be out of fire." Here, then, he declares that all the other gods are nourished, except the cosmos and Zeus. But in the first book on providence, he says that Zeus grows until he has consumed everything into himself. For since death is the separation of soul from body, and the soul of the cosmos is not separated but grows continually, until it has consumed all matter into itself, one must not say that the cosmos dies. Who, then, could appear to contradict himself more than one who says that the same God now grows and now is not nourished. And this need not be inferred by reasoning, for he himself has clearly written in the same work. The cosmos alone is said to be self-sufficient, because it alone has within itself all that it needs, and it is nourished from itself and grows, its other parts being exchanged into one another. So not only does he, in the former passage, declare that the other gods are nourished, except the cosmos and Zeus, but in these passages he says that the cosmos too is nourished, and thus fights against himself. And even more so, in that he says the cosmos grows by being nourished from itself. The opposite would have been reasonable, that this alone should not grow, having its own decay as its nourishment, while for the other gods, nourished from outside, there should be increase and growth, and the cosmos should rather be consumed into them, if indeed it is the case that the cosmos takes something from itself, while they always take something from it and are nourished. Secondly, then, the conception of the gods includes happiness and blessedness and self-sufficiency. Hence they also praise Euripides for saying, "For God, if he is truly God, needs nothing. These are the wretched tales of poets." But Chrysippus himself, in the passages I have cited, says that the cosmos alone is self-sufficient, because it alone has within itself all that it needs. What then follows from the cosmos alone being self-sufficient? That neither the sun is self-sufficient, nor the moon, nor any of the other gods, and not being self-sufficient, they could not be happy or blessed. The infant in the womb is believed by nature to be nourished like a plant, but when it is born, being cooled by the air and hardened, its breath changes and becomes an animal. Hence it is not inappropriate that the soul's psyche is named from cooling Psyxis. But he himself, again, holds that the soul is a rarer and finer breath than nature's, thereby contradicting himself. For how can something fine-particled come to be out of something coarse-particled, and rarefied, by means of chilling and condensation? And what is more serious, how, declaring that the ensouled comes to be by chilling, does he hold the sun to be ensouled, the sun being fiery and having come to be from exhalation changed into fire? For he says in the first book on nature, "The transformation of fire is of this kind, through air it turns into water, and from this, as earth settles out, air is exhaled, and as the air becomes finer, the ether is poured round it in a circle, and the stars are kindled out of the sea together with the sun." What then is more opposed to kindling than chilling, or to condensation than dispersal? He makes water and earth out of fire and air, but the wet and earthy element he turns into fire and air. Yet even so, sometimes he makes kindling and sometimes cooling the origin of ensoulment. Moreover, when the conflagration occurs, he says the cosmos lives entirely and is a living creature, but when it is quenched again and thickens into water and earth and the corporeal, he says otherwise. He writes in the first book on Providence, "For while the cosmos is wholly fiery, it is at once both its own soul and its own governing faculty. But when it changes into the moist state, and the soul that is left within it changes in a certain way into body and soul, so as to be composed of these, it acquires a different account." Here, then, he clearly says that at the conflagration, even the soulless parts of the cosmos turn into the ensouled. But at the quenching, conversely, the soul too is relaxed and moistened, changing into the corporeal. He thus appears absurd, making by cooling now living things out of insensate ones, and now turning the greater part of the soul of the cosmos into insensate and soulless things. And apart from these points, his account of the generation of the soul itself is at odds with his own doctrine, as his proof shows. For he says the soul comes into being when the infant is born, its breath being tempered, as it were, by the cooling like a hardening of steel, and he uses as proof that the soul comes into being and is later in origin, the fact, above all, that children come to resemble their parents in character and disposition. But the contradiction between these claims is plain. It is not possible for the soul to be shaped in character before birth, since it comes into being only after birth. Or else it will follow that, before the soul exists, it is similar to a soul. That is, that it both is, by virtue of the similarity, and is not, because it has not yet come to be. And if someone should say that, since the resemblance arises in the mixtures of the bodies, the souls, once they have come into being, change accordingly, this destroys the very evidence for the souls having come into being. For it is possible in this way, even for something ungenerated, to change, once it enters in, according to the mixture producing the resemblance. As for air, he sometimes says it is naturally light and tends upward, sometimes that it is neither heavy nor light. In the second book on motion, he says, fire, being weightless, tends upward, and air similarly so, water being assigned rather to earth and air to fire. But in the physical treatises, he inclines to the opposite view, that air has of itself neither weight nor lightness. He says air is by nature dark, and uses this as evidence that it is also primarily cold. For its darkness is opposed to brightness, and its coldness to the heat of fire. Having set these views in motion in the first book on physical problems, again in the treatises on habitual states, he says, habitual states are nothing other than currents of air. For it is by these that bodies are held together, and the air that holds together is the cause of each thing held together by such a state being of a certain quality, the air which they call hardness in iron, density in stone, whiteness in silver. This involves great absurdity and inconsistency. For if the air remains such as it is by nature, how does blackness arise as whiteness in what is not white, softness as hardness in what is not hard, and looseness as density in what is not dense? But if, mixing with these things, it departs from its own nature and is assimilated to them, how is it a habitual state, or a power, or a cause of these things, by which it is itself overpowered? For this is a case of being acted upon, not of acting or holding together, but of being weakened, such a change, in the course of which it loses its own qualities. Even though everywhere they declare matter to lie inert and unmoved of itself beneath the qualities, while the qualities, being currents of air and tensions of an airy nature, in whatever parts of matter they come to be present, give each thing its form and shape. But they cannot say this while positing that air is by nature of this sort. For being a habitual state and a tension, it will assimilate each of the bodies to itself, so that they will be black and soft. But if by its mixture with those bodies it takes on the opposite forms which it does not naturally have, then it is, in a sense, itself matter, and is not a cause of matter, nor a power over it. As for the claim, often made by him, that the void outside the cosmos is infinite, and that the infinite has neither beginning, middle, nor end, this is often said by him. And by this above all they do away, from its own premises, with the downward motion of the atom asserted by Epicurus. Since in the infinite there is no differentiation by which the one direction is conceived as up and the other as down. Yet in the fourth book on possibilities, having posited a certain middle place and middle region, he says there that the cosmos has settled and the passage runs thus. Hence, as to whether one should say that the cosmos is perishable, I think this needs argument. Nevertheless, to me it appears rather to be so. But something like everlastingness is greatly assisted for it by its occupation of the middle region, namely, its being in the middle. Since if it were conceived as existing elsewhere, destruction would attach to it altogether. And a little later again, for in this way, somehow, the substance too has come to occupy the middle place eternally, being from the start of such a kind that, though it might in another way, yet because of this coincidence it does not admit destruction, and on this very account is eternal. This passage contains one manifest and evident contradiction, leaving a certain middle place and middle region in the infinite, and a second, less obvious but even more irrational than this. For in supposing that the cosmos would not remain indestructible, if its settlement had come about by chance in some other part of the void, he plainly reveals his fear that, the parts of its substance being carried toward the middle, dissolution and destruction of the cosmos would occur. Yet he would have no such fear if he did not suppose that bodies are naturally born everywhere toward the middle, not the middle of the substance, but of the region that surrounds the substance. About this, he has often said that it is impossible and contrary to nature, for there exists in the void no differentiation by which bodies are drawn hither rather than thither. But it is the arrangement of this cosmos that is the cause of the motion toward its center and middle, of things inclining and being born from every direction. It suffices for this purpose to cite a passage from the second book on motion. Having first said that the cosmos as a whole is a perfect body, but the parts of the cosmos are not perfect, in that they stand in a certain relation to the whole and do not exist by themselves. And having gone on to discuss its motion, saying that, it is naturally moved, through all its parts, toward its own coherence and cohesion, not toward its dissolution and disintegration. Having said this, he adds, since the whole is thus stretched toward the same point and is in motion, and the parts have this motion by virtue of the nature of body, it is plausible that for all bodies the primary motion in accordance with nature is toward the middle of the cosmos itself being thus moved toward itself, and its parts being moved as parts belonging to it. Then, one might say, my good man, what happened to you, that you forgot these arguments, so as to declare the cosmos dissoluble and perishable if it had not by chance occupied the middle region? For if the cosmos itself is naturally always inclined toward its own middle, and its parts are everywhere straining toward this, wherever it may be shifted within the void, thus holding itself together and enclosing itself, it will remain indestructible and unbroken. For things that are broken and scattered suffer this through the separation of each of their parts and their dissolution toward their own proper place, as it flows away from what is contrary to nature. But you, positing the cosmos as situated in a different part of the void, suppose that it would thereby be joined to utter destruction, and in speaking thus, and for this reason seeking a middle in the infinite, which by nature has no middle, you have abandoned those tensions and cohesions and inclinations, on the ground that they offer no security for its preservation, and have assigned the entire cause of its permanence to the occupation of place. And yet you attach the following to what you have already said, as though you were eager to refute yourself. The manner in which each of the parts, being connected with the rest, is moved, it is reasonable that it should also be moved in the same way by itself. And if, for the sake of argument, we should conceive of it and suppose it to be in some void outside this cosmos, then, just as it would have been moved toward the middle while being held together on every side, it will remain in this same motion, even if, for the sake of argument, a void should suddenly come to be around it. Then again, any part whatsoever, when surrounded by void, does not lose its inclination leading toward the middle of the cosmos. Yet the cosmos itself, unless chance provides for it the middle region, will lose its power of cohesion, its parts being carried off in different directions elsewhere. These points, then, contain great contradictions with the physical doctrine, but the following point already bears also on the doctrine concerning God and providence, namely, that in attributing the most trivial of causes to these things, he takes away the most authoritative and greatest cause. For what is more authoritative than the permanence of the cosmos and its substance being held together, united with its parts, toward itself? Yet this, according to Chrysippus, has come about by pure chance. For if the occupation of place is the cause of indestructibility, and this came about by coincidence, it is clear that the preservation of the universe is the work of chance, not of fate and providence. And how does his account of possibles not conflict with his account of fate? For if, as Diodorus holds, nothing is possible except what either is or will be true, but rather everything that admits of coming to be, even if it is not going to come to be, is possible, then many things will be possible which are not in accordance with fate, fate being, as Chrysippus maintains, invincible, irresistible, and prevailing over all things. Either fate loses its power, or, if it is of such a kind as Chrysippus holds, that which admits of coming to be will often fall into the impossible. And every true statement will be necessary, being seized by the most authoritative of all necessities, and every false statement will be impossible, having the greatest cause working against its becoming true. For the man fated to die at sea, how can he at the same time admit of dying on land? And again, is it possible for the man at Megara to go to Athens, if he is prevented by fate? Moreover, what he says about impressions vigorously conflicts with fate as well. For wishing to show that the impression is not by itself a sufficient cause of assent, he has said, the wise will do harm by producing false impressions, if impressions by themselves produce assents. For the wise often use falsehood against the wicked and present a persuasive impression, yet not one that is the cause of assent, since otherwise it will also be the cause of the false supposition and of the deception. If then, one were to transfer this from the case of the wise man to the case of fate, and say that assents do not come about because of fate, then, since it is because of fate that there will also be false assents and suppositions and deceptions, and men will be harmed because of fate, The very argument that exempts the wise man from doing harm at the same time proves that fate is not the cause of all things. For if men neither hold opinions nor are harmed because of fate, it is clear that they neither act rightly nor think soundly nor form firm suppositions nor are benefited because of fate either. And the claim that fate is the cause of all things vanishes. But one who says that Chrysippus made fate not the complete cause of these things, but only their preliminary cause, will find him again contradicting himself elsewhere, where he praises Homer to excess for saying, about Zeus, "Hold fast to whatever ill or good he sends to each of you," and Euripides, "O Zeus, why should I say that wretched mortals have understanding? For we depend on you, and do such things as you happen to think." He himself writes much in agreement with these lines, and says in the end that nothing, not even the least thing, moves or is checked otherwise than in accordance with the reason of Zeus, which he says is the same as fate. Furthermore, the preliminary cause is weaker than the complete cause, and does not prevail, being overpowered by other causes rising up against it. But he declares fate to be an invincible, unhindered, and unalterable cause, and himself calls it atropos, and adrasteia, and necessity, and fate, as setting a limit upon all things. Should we then say that ascents are not in our power, nor virtues, nor vices, nor right action, nor error, or should we say that fate is deficient and that destiny is unfulfilled, and the motions and dispositions of Zeus are ineffectual? For from these follow, on the one hand, its being a complete cause, and on the other, its being only a preliminary cause of fate. For being a complete cause of all things does away with what is in our power and what is voluntary, while being a preliminary cause destroys its being unhindered and effective. For not once or twice, but everywhere, indeed in all his physical writings, he has written, "For the particular natures and motions many obstacles and hindrances arise, but for the nature of the whole, none." And how, when the particular motions are hindered and obstructed, can the motion of the whole that extends into them be itself unimpeded and unhindered? For neither is the nature of man unimpeded, if that of the foot or the hand is not. Nor would the motion of a ship be unhindered, if the activities concerning the sail or the rowing meet with certain hindrances. And apart from these points, if impressions do not come about in accordance with fate, then fate is not the cause of ascents. But if, because it produces impressions leading to ascent, ascents are said to come about in accordance with fate, how does it not often conflict with itself, producing, in matters of the greatest moment, differing impressions and dragging the mind toward opposite sides? As when they say that those who assent to the one impression and do not withhold judgment err. If they yield to unclear impressions, falling short, if to false ones, being wholly deceived, and if, or opine, when assenting to things that are simply non-apprehensible. And yet, since there are three possibilities, one of them must hold. Either not every impression is the work of fate, or every acceptance of an impression and every assent is free of error, or fate itself is not beyond reproach. For I do not see how it can be blameless in producing impressions of such a kind that not to fight against them, not to resist, but to follow and yield to them, is itself blameworthy. Indeed, in his debates against the academics, what was the greater part of the argument, for Chrysippus himself and for Antipater, concerned with? It concerned the claim that one should neither act nor have impulse without assent, and that those who maintain that, once the appropriate impression occurs, one should have impulse at once without yielding or assenting, are uttering fictions and empty suppositions. And again, Chrysippus says that God instills false impressions, and so does the wise man, not because they need us to assent or yield, but only to act and to have impulse toward what appears. Whereas we, being inferior, assent to such impressions because of our weakness. Now the confusion and inconsistency of these statements, set against one another, is not at all hard to see. For he who does not need people to assent, but only to act, he who instills the impressions in them, whether God or the sage knows that, for the purpose of acting, the impressions suffice, and that assents are superfluous. So that if, knowing that an impression does not by itself produce an impulse to act apart from assent, he nevertheless creates false and persuasive impressions, he is himself willingly responsible for people falling into error and going wrong by assenting to things non-apprehensible.